Did you enjoy the service? For a clergyman, I think he's such an interesting man.
We don't see you nearly often enough, Mr. Baker said. I remember your grandfather sitting in that very chair and reporting that the dirty Spaniards had sunk the main. He spilled his tea, only it wasn't tea. Old Captain Hawley used to lace his rum with a little tea. He was a truculent man. Some thought a quarrelsome man.
I could see that Mary was first shaken and then pleased at this warmth. Of course, she didn't know I had promoted her to be an heiress. A reputation for money is almost as negotiable as money itself. Mrs. Baker, her head jerking with some nervous disorder, poured tea into cups as thin and fragile as magnolia petals, and her pouring hand was the only steady part of her. Mr. Baker stirred with a thoughtful spoon.
I don't know whether I love tea or the ceremony of it, he said. I like all ceremonies, even the silly ones.
I think I understand, I said. This morning I felt comfortable in the service because I had no surprises. I knew the words before they were said.
During the war, Ethan, listen to this, ladies, and see if you can remember anything like it. During the war, I served as a consultant to the Secretary of War. I spent some time in Washington.
I hated it, said Mrs. Baker.
Well, there was a big military tea, a real doozer, maybe 500 guests. The ranking lady was the wife of a five-star general, and next in importance was the lady of a lieutenant general. Mrs. Secretary, the hostess, asked the five-star lady to pour the tea and Mrs. Three-star to pour the coffee. Well, the top lady refused because, and I quote her, everyone knows coffee outranks tea. Now, did you ever hear that?
He chuckled.
As it turns out, whiskey outranked everybody.
It was such a restless place, Mrs. Baker said. People moved before they had time to gather a set of habits or manners. Mary told her story of an Irish tea in Boston, with the water boiling in round tubs over an open fire, and served with tin ladles. And they don't steep, they boil, she said. That tea will unsettle varnish on a table. There must be ritual preliminaries to a serious discussion or action, and the sharper the manner is, the longer and lighter must the singing be. Each person must add a bit of feather or a colored patch. If Mary and Mrs. Baker were not to be part of the serious matter, they would long since have set up their own pattern of exchange. Mr. Baker had poured wine on the earth of conversation, and so had my Mary, and she was pleased and excited by their attentiveness. It remained for Mrs. Baker and me to contribute, and I felt it only decent to be last. She took her turn and drew her source from the teapot as the others had.
"I remember when there were dozens of kinds of tea," she offered brightly. "Why, everyone had recipes for nearly everything. I guess there wasn't a weed or leaf or flower that wasn't made into some kind of tea. Now there are only two, India and China, and not much China. Remember tansy and chamomile and orange leaf and flower and cambric?"
"What's cambric?" Mary asked.
"Equal parts hot water and hot milk. Children love it. It doesn't taste like milk and water."
That accounted for Mrs. Baker. It was my turn, and I intended to make a few carefully meaningless remarks about the Boston Tea Party. But you can't always do what you intended. Surprises slip out, not waiting for permission.
I went to sleep after service, I heard me say. I dreamed of Danny Taylor, a dreadful dream. You remember Danny? Poor chap, said Mr. Baker.
Once we were closer than brothers. I had no brother.
I guess we were brothers in a way. I don't carry it out, of course, but I feel I should be my brother Danny's keeper.
Mary was annoyed with me for breaking the pattern of the conversation. She took a small revenge.
Ethan gives him money. I don't think it's right. He just uses it to get drunk.
Well, said Mr. Baker. I wonder. Anyway, the dream was a noonmare. I give him so little, a dollar now and then. What else can he do with a dollar but get drunk? Maybe with a decent amount he could get well.
No one would dare do that, Mary cried. That would be after killing him. Isn't that so, Mr. Baker?
Poor chap, Mr. Baker said. A fine family, the Taylors were. Makes me sick to see him this way. But Mary's right. He'd probably drink himself to death.
He is anyway. But he's safe from me. I don't have a decent amount to give him.
It's the principle, Mr. Baker said.
Mrs. Baker contributed a feminine savagery. He should be in an institution where they could look after him.
All three were annoyed with me. I should have stayed with the Boston Tea Party.
Strange how the mind goes romping, playing blind man's bluff or pin the tail on the donkey, when it should be using every observation to find a path through the minefield of secret plans and submerged obstacles. I understood the house of Baker and the house of Hawley, the dark walls and curtains, the funereal rubber plants unacquainted with sun, the portraits and prints and remembrances of other times in pottery and scrimshaw, in fabrics and wood, which bolt it to reality and to permanence. Chairs change with style and comfort, but chests and tables, bookcases and desks relate to a solid past. Hawley was more than a family. It was a house. And that was why poor Danny held on to Taylor Meadow. Without it, no family. And soon, not even a name. By tone and inflection and desire, the three sitting there had canceled him. It may be that some men require a house and a history to reassure themselves that they exist. It's a slim enough connection, at most. In the store, I was a failure and a clerk. In my house, I was Hawley. So I too must be unsure. Baker could offer a hand to Hawley. Without my house, I too would have been canceled. It was not man to man, but house to house. I resented the removal from real of Danny Taylor, but I couldn't stop it. And this thought sharpened and tempered me. Baker was going to try to refurbish Hawley for Baker's participation in Mary's fancied inheritance. Now I was on the edge of the minefield. My heart hardened against my selfless benefactor. I felt it harden and grow wary and dangerous. And with its direction came the feeling of combat and the laws of controlled savagery. And the first law is, let even your defense have the appearance of attack. I said, Mr. Baker, we don't need to go over the background. You know better than I do the slow, precise way in which my father lost the Hawley substance. I was away at war. How did it happen?
It wasn't his intention, but his judgment.
I know he was unworldly, but how did it happen?
Well, it was a time of wild investment. He invested wildly.
Did he have any advice?
He put his money in munitions that were already obsolete. Then when the contracts were canceled, he lost.
You were in Washington. Did you know about the contracts?
Only in a general way.
But enough so you didn't invest.
No, I didn't.
Did you advise my father about investments?
I was in Washington.
But you knew he had borrowed the money on the Hawley property, the money to invest.
Yes, I knew that.
Did you advise against it?
I was in Washington.
But your bank foreclosed.
Well, a bank doesn't have any choice, Ethan, you know that.
Yes, I know. Only it's a shame you couldn't have advised him.
You shouldn't blame him, Ethan.
Now that I understand it, I don't. I didn't mean to blame him, but I never quite knew what happened. I think Mr. Baker had prepared an opening. Having lost his chance, he had to grope about for his next move. He coughed, blew his nose, and wiped it with a paper handkerchief from a flat pocket package. Wiped his eyes with a second sheet. Polished his glasses with a third. Everyone has his own method for gaining time. I've known a man to take 5 minutes to fill and light a pipe. When he was ready again, I said, "I know I have no right in myself to ask you for help, but you yourself brought up the long partnership of our families."
"Good people," he said, "and usually men of excellent judgment, conservative,
but not blindly so, sir. I believe that once they decided on a course, they drove through."
"That they did."
"Even if it came to sinking an enemy or burning a ship?"
"They were commissioned, of course."
"In 1801, I believe, sir, they were questioned about what constituted an enemy."
"There's always some readjustment after a war."
"Surely. But I'm not taking up old scores for talk. Frankly, Mr. Baker, I want to rehabilitate my fortunes."
"That's the spirit, Ethan. For a time I thought you'd lost the old Hawley touch."
"I had. Or maybe I'd not developed it. You've offered help. Where do I start?"
"The trouble is, you need capital to start."
"I know that, but if I had some capital, where would I start?"
"This must be tiresome for the ladies," he said. "Maybe we should go into the library. Business is dull to ladies."
Mrs. Baker stood up. "I was just about to ask Mary to help me select some wallpaper for the big bedroom. The samples are upstairs, Mary."
"I'd like Mary to hear." But she went along with them, as I knew she would.
"I don't know a thing about business," she said, "but I do know about wallpaper."
"But you're concerned, darling."
"I just get mixed up, Ethan. You know I do."
"Maybe I'll get more mixed up without you, darling."
Mr. Baker had probably suggested the wallpaper bit. I think his wife does not choose the paper. Surely no woman picked the dark and geometric paper in the room where we sat.
"Now," he said when they were gone, "your problem is capital, Ethan. Your house is clear. You can mortgage it."
"I won't do that."
"Well, I can respect that, but it's the only collateral you have. There's also Mary's money. It's not much, but with some money you can get more money."
"I don't want to touch her money. That's her safety."
"Well, it's in a joint account, and it's not earning anything."
"Let's say I overcame my scruples. What have you in mind?"
"Have you any idea what her mother's worth?"
"No, but it seems substantial." He cleaned his glasses with great care.
"What I say is bound to be in confidence."
"Of course."
"Fortunately, I know you're not a talker. No Hawley ever was. Except perhaps your father. Now, I know as a businessman that New Baytown is going to grow. It has everything to make it grow. A harbor, beaches, inland waters. And once it starts, nothing can stop it. A good businessman owes it to his town to help it develop."
"And take profit."
"Naturally."
"Why hasn't it developed?"
"Well, I think you know that. The mossbacks on the council. They're living in the past. They hold back progress."
It always interested me to hear how philanthropic the taking of a profit can be. Stripped of its forward-looking, good-of-the-community clothing, Mr. Baker's place was just what it had to be. He and a few others, a very few, would support the town's present administrations until they had bought or controlled all the future facilities. Then they would turn the council and the town manager out and let progress reign, and only then would it be discovered that they owned every avenue through which it could come. From pure sentiment, he was willing to cut me in for a small share. I don't know whether or not he had intended to let me know the timetable, or whether his enthusiasm got the better of him, but it did come through the generalities. The town election is July 7th. By that time, the forward-looking group must have the wheels of progress under control. I don't suppose there's a man in the world who doesn't love to give advice. As I maintained a small reluctance, my teacher grew more vehement and more specific. "I'll have to think about it, sir," I said. "What's easy for you is a mystery to me, and of course, I'll have to discuss it with Mary."
"Now, that's where I think you're wrong," he said. "There's too much petticoat in business today."
"But it's her inheritance."
"Best thing you can do for her is to make her some money for a surprise. They like it better that way."
"I hope I don't sound ungrateful, Mr. Baker. I think slowly. I'll just have to mull it over. Did you hear Marullo's going to Italy?" His eyes sharpened.
"For good?"
"No, just a visit."
"Well, I hope he makes some arrangements to protect you in case something happened to him. He's not a young man. Has he made a will?"
"I don't know."
"If a bunch of his WAP relations moved in, you might find yourself out of a job."
I retired into a protective vagueness. "You've given me a lot to chew on," I said, "but I wonder if you can give me a little idea of when you will start."
"I can tell you this. Development is pretty much dependent on transportation."
"Well, the big throughways are moving out."
"Still a long way to come. The kind of men with the kind of money we want to attract will want to come by air."
"And we have no airport?"
"That's right."
"Furthermore, we have no place for an airport without pushing hills around."
"An expensive operation. The cost of labor would be prohibitive."
"Then what's your plan?"
"Ethan, you'll have to trust me and forgive me. I can't tell you that at this time. But I do promise that if you can raise some capital, I'll see that you get in on the ground floor. And I can tell you that there is a very definite situation, but it has to be solved."
"Well, I guess that's better than I deserve.
The old families must stick together."
"Is Marullo part of the group?"
"Certainly not. He goes his own way with his own crowd."
"They do pretty well, don't they?"
"Better than I think's healthy. I don't like to see these foreigners creeping in."
"And July 7th is the sound-off."
"Did I say that?"
"No, I guess I just imagined it."
"You must have."
And with that, Mary came back from the wallpaper. We did our courteous duties and walked slowly toward home. "They just couldn't have been nicer. What did he say?"
"Same old thing. I should use your money to get a start, and I won't do it."
"I know you're thinking of me, dear. But I say if you don't take his advice, you're a fool."
"I don't like it, Mary. Suppose he's wrong. You'd be without protection."
"I tell you this, Ethan, if you don't do it, I'll take the money and hand it over to him. I promise you I will."
"Let me think about it. I don't want to involve you in business."
"You don't have to. That money's in a joint account. You know what the fortune said."
"Oh, Lord, the fortune again."
"Well, I believe it."
"If I lost your money, you'd hate me."
"I wouldn't. You are my fortune. That's what Margie said."
"What Margie said is in my head, in letters read, until I'm dead."
"Don't make a joke."
"Maybe I'm not. Don't let fortune spoil the sweetness of our failure."
"I don't see how a little money could spoil anything. Not a lot of money, just enough."
I didn't answer.
"Well, do you?"
I said, "O prince's daughter, there is no such thing as just enough money. Only two measures, no money and not enough money."
"Why, that's not true."
"That is true. Remember the Texas billionaire who died recently? He lived in a hotel room and out of a suitcase. He left no will, no heirs, but he didn't have enough money. The more you have, the less enough it is."
she said sarcastically. I suppose you find it sinful for me to want new living room curtains, and a water heater big enough so four people can bathe the same day and I can wash dishes, too.
I was not reporting on sin, you juggins. I was stating a fact, a law of nature.
You seem to have no respect for human nature.
Not human nature, my Mary. Nature. Squirrels bank 10 times as many hickory nuts as they can ever use. The pocket gopher, with a stomach full to bursting, still loads his cheeks like sacks. And how much of the honey the clever bees collect do the clever bees eat?
When Mary's confused or perplexed, she spurts anger the way an octopus spurts ink, and hides in the dark cloud of it.
You make me sick, she said. You can't let anyone have a little happiness.
My darling, it isn't that. It's a despairing unhappiness I'm afraid of. The panic money brings, the protectiveness and the envy. She must have been unconsciously fearful of the same thing. She struck at me, probed for a hurting place, and found it, and twisted the jagged words.
Here's a grocery clerk without a bean, worried about how bad it will be when he's rich. You act as though you could pick up a fortune any time you want to.
I think I can.
How?
That's the worry.
You don't know how, or you'd have done it before. You're just bluffing. You always bluff.
The intent to wound raises rage. I could feel the fever rise in me. Ugly, desperate words moved up like venom. I felt a sour hatefulness.
Mary said,
Look, there it goes. Did you see it?
Where? What?
Went right past the tree there and into our yard.
What was it, Mary? Tell me, what did you see?
In the dusk I saw her smile. That incredible female smile. It's called wisdom, but it isn't that, but rather an understanding that makes wisdom unnecessary.
You didn't see anything, Mary.
I saw a quarrel, but it got away. I put my arm about her and turned her. Let's go around the block before we go in. We strolled in the tunnel of the night, and we didn't speak again, or need to.
Chapter 8. As a child, I hunted and killed small creatures with energy and joy. Rabbits and squirrels, small birds, and later ducks and wild geese came crashing down, rumpled distortions of bone and blood and fur and feathers. There was a savage creativeness about it, without hatred or rancor or guilt. The war retired my appetite for destruction. Perhaps I was like a child overindulged in sweets. A shotgun's blast was no longer a shout of fierce happiness. In this first spring, a bouncing pair of rabbits paid daily visits to our garden. They loved best my Mary's carnations, ate them down to raw crowns. "You have to get rid of them," Mary said. I brought out my 12-bore, sticky with grease, and found some old thickened shells with No. 5 shot. In the evening I sat on the back steps, and when the rabbits were in line, I blasted both of them with 1 shot. Then I buried the furry ruins under the big lilac, and I was miserable in the stomach. It was simply that I had grown unused to killing things. A man can get used to anything. Slaughtering, or undertaking, or even execution. Rack and pincers must be just a job when one gets used to it. When the children had gone to bed, I said, I'm going out for a while. Mary didn't ask where or why, as she would have a few days ago.
Shall you be late?
No, not late.
I won't wait up. I'm sleepy, she said.
And it seemed that, having accepted a direction, she was farther along than I. I still had the rabbit misery.
Perhaps it's natural for a man who's destroyed something to try to restore a balance by creating something. But was that my impulse? I fumbled my way into the stinking kennel where Danny Taylor lived. A lighted candle burned in a saucer beside his army cot. Danny was in bad shape, blue and gaunt and sick. His skin had a pewter sheen. It was hard not to be sick of the smell of the dirty place and the dirty man under a filthy comforter. His eyes were open and glazed. I expected him to babble in delirium. It was a shock when he spoke clearly and in the tone and manner of Danny Taylor. "What do you want here, Heath?" "I want to help you." "You know better than that. You're sick." "Think I don't know it? I know it better than anyone." He groped behind his cot and brought out a bottle of Old Forester, 1/3 full. "Have a shot?" "No, Danny. That's expensive whiskey." "I have friends who gave it to you." "That's none of your business, Heath." He took a drink and kept it down, but for a moment it was not easy. And then his color came back. He laughed. "My friend wanted to talk business, but I fooled him. I passed out before he could get it said. He didn't know how little it takes. You want to talk business, Heath? 'Cause I can pass out again quick." "Do you have any feelings about me, Danny? Any trust? Any, well, feeling?" "Sure I do. But when it comes right down to it, I'm a drunk, and a drunk feels strongest about liquor." "If I could raise the money, would you go for a cure?" The frightening thing was how quickly he had become normal and easy and like himself. "I might say I would, Heath, but you don't know drunks. I'd take the money and drink it up." "Well, suppose I paid it right to the hospital or wherever." "I'm trying to tell you, I'd go with the best intentions, and in a few days I'd get out. You can't trust a drunk, Heath. That's what you can't understand. No matter what I did or said, I'd still get out." "Don't you want to come out of it, Danny?" "I guess I don't. I guess you know what I want." He hoisted the bottle again. And again I was astonished at the speed of his reaction. Not only did he become the old Danny I knew, but his senses and perceptions were sharpened, so clear, in fact, that he read my thought. "Don't trust it," he said. "It's only for a little time. Alcohol stimulates and then depresses. I hope you won't stay around to see that. Right now, I don't believe it'll happen. I never do when I'm up." Then his eyes, wet and shining in the candlelight, looked into me. "Ethan," he said, "you offered to pay for a cure for me. You haven't the money, Ethan." "I could get it. Mary inherited some from a brother." "And you would give me that?" "Yes." "Even though I tell you never trust a drunk? Even if I assure you I would take your money and break your heart?" "You're breaking my heart now, Danny. I had a dream about you. We were out at the old place, remember?" He raised the bottle and then put it down, saying, "No, not yet. Not yet. Heath, never, never trust a drunk. When I'm... horrible. A dead thing. There's still a clever, secret mind at work, and it's not a friendly mind. Right now, right at this moment, I'm a man who was your friend. I lied to you about passing out. Oh, I passed out all right. But I know about the bottle." "Wait," I said, "before you go any further, else it will look, well, you might suspect me. It was Baker brought the bottle, wasn't it?"
"Yes."
"He wanted you to sign something."
"Yes, but I passed out."
He chuckled to himself
and again lifted the bottle to his lips, but in the candlelight I saw the smallest bubble. He had taken only a drop. "That's one of the things I wanted to tell you, Danny." "Was it the old place you wanted?"
"Yes."
"How does it happen you haven't sold it?"
"I thought I told you. It makes me a gentleman, lacking only the conduct of a gentleman."
"Don't sell it, Danny. Hold on to it."
"What's it to you? Why not?"
"For your pride."
"I don't have any pride left. Only position."
"Yes, you have. When you asked me for money, you were ashamed. That means pride."
"No, I told you. That was a trick. Drunks are clever, I tell you. It embarrassed you, and you gave me a buck because you thought I was ashamed. I wasn't ashamed. I just wanted a drink."
"Don't sell it, Danny. It's valuable. Baker knows it. He doesn't buy anything without value."
"What's valuable about it?"
"It's the only place nearby level enough for an airfield."
"I see."
"If you'll hold out, it can be a whole new start for you, Danny. Hold on to it. You could take the cure, and when you came out, you'd have a nest egg."
"But no nest. Maybe I'd rather sell it and drink it up, and when the bough breaks, the cradle will fall, and down will come baby cradle and all."
He sang shrilly and laughed.
"Do you want the place, Eth? Is that why you came here?"
"I want you to be well."
"I am well."
"I want to explain, Danny. If you were a bum, you could be free to do whatever you want. But you have something a group of forward-looking citizens want and need.
Taylor Meadow. And I'm going to hold on to it. I'm forward-looking, too."
He glanced affectionately at the bottle. "Danny, I told you. It's the only place for an airport. It's a key place. They have to have it. Either that or level the hills, and they can't afford that."
"Then I have them by the yin-yang, and I'm going to twist."
"You've forgotten, Danny. A man of property is a precious vessel. Already I've heard that the kindest thing would be to put you in an institution where you could get the care you need."
"They wouldn't dare."
"Oh, yes, they would. And feel virtuous about it. You know the process. The judge, you know him, would rule you incompetent to handle property. He would appoint a guardian, and I can guess which one. And all this would be expensive, so of course your property would have to be sold to pay the costs, and guess who would be there to buy it?" His eyes were shiny, and he listened with his mouth parted. Now he looked away.
"You're trying to scare me, Eth. You picked the wrong time. Catch me in the morning when I'm cold and the world is green vomit. Right now, my strength, it is the strength of 10 because the bottle's here."
He waved it like a sword, and his eyes went to slits gleaming in the candlelight.
"Did I tell you, Eth? I think I did. A drunk has a special evil kind of intelligence."
"But I've told you what will happen."
"I agree with you. I know it's true. You've made your point. But instead of scaring me, you've roused my imp. Whoever thinks a drunk is helpless is crazy. A drunk is a very special vehicle with special abilities. I can fight back, and right now I seem to want to."
"Good boy. That's what I want to hear." He sighted at me over the neck of the whiskey bottle as though it were the bead on the end of a rifle.
"You'd loan me Mary's money?"
"Yes."
"Without security?"
"Yes."
"Knowing the chance of getting it back is 1,000 to 1 against?"
"Yes."
"There's an ugly thing in a drunk, Eth. I don't believe you."
He licked his dry lips.
"Would you put the money in my hands?"
"Whatever you say."
"I told you not to."
"But I will." This time he tipped the bottle back, and the big bubble rose inside the glass. When he stopped drinking, His eyes were even shinier, but they were cold and impersonal as a snake's eyes.
Can you get the money this week, Eth?
Yes.
Wednesday?
Yes.
Have you got a couple of bucks now?
I had just that. A dollar bill, a half, a quarter, two dimes and a nickel, and three pennies. I poured them into his outstretched hand. He finished the bottle and dropped it on the floor.
Somehow, I never put you down for clever, Eth. Do you know even a basic cure would cost about $1,000?
All right.
This is fun, Eth. This isn't chess, it's poker. I used to be pretty good at poker. Too good. You're betting I'll put up my meadow as collateral. And you're betting that $1,000 worth of booze will kill me. And there you'll be with an airport in your lap.
That's a nasty thing, Danny.
I warned you I was nasty.
Couldn't you think I meant it the way I said it?
No. But I've got a way to keep it the way you said it. You remember me in the old days, Eth? Do you think I don't remember you? You're the kid with the built-in judge. Okay. I'm getting dry. The bottle's empty. I'm going out. My price is $1,000.
All right.
In cash on Wednesday.
I'll bring it.
No note, no signature, no nothing. And don't think you remember me, Ethan, from the old days. My friend here has changed all that. I have no loyalty, no fairness. What you'll get is nothing but hearty laughter.
I would only ask you to try.
Sure, I'll promise, Ethan. But I hope I've convinced you what a drunk's promise is worth. Just bring the cash. Stay as long as you like. My house is your house. I'm going out. See you Wednesday, Eth.
He eased himself up out of the old army cot, flung the comforter behind it, and walked out with a rolling gait. His pants were not zipped up. I sat for a while, watching the candle gutter down into the grease of the saucer. Everything he said was true, except one thing on which I placed my bet. He hadn't changed that much. Somewhere in the wreckage was Danny Taylor. I didn't believe he could amputate Danny. I loved Danny, and I was prepared to do just what he said. I was. From a distance I heard him singing in a clear, high falsetto.
Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing. Onward, the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king over the sea to sky.
After a lonely while, I blew out the candle and walked home by way of High Street. Willie wasn't asleep yet in the police car.
"Seems to me you're out a lot, Eth," he said.
"You know how it is."
"Sure. Spring. Young man's fancy."
Mary was asleep, smiling, but when I slipped in beside her, she half-awaked. The misery was in my stomach, the cold, hurting misery. Mary turned on her side and gathered me into her warm, grass-smelling body, and I needed her. I knew the misery would get less, but right now I needed her. I don't know whether she really awakened, but even sleeping, she knew my need. And afterward, she was awake, and she said, "I suppose you're hungry."
"Yes, Helen."
"What do you want?"
"Onion sandwich. No, two onion sandwiches on rye bread."
"I'll have to have one to stand you."
"Don't you want one?"
"Of course." She padded down the stairs and came back in a little while with sandwiches and a carton of milk and two glasses.
It was a pretty hot onion. "Mary Muldoon," I began.
"Wait till you swallow."
"Did you mean that about not wanting to know about business?"
"Why, yes."
"Well, I have a lead. I won $1,000.
"Was it something Mr. Baker told you?"
"In a way, but private, too."
"Well, you just write a check."
"No, darling. I want you to get it in cash. And you might pass the word at the bank that you're getting new furniture or rugs or something."
"But I'm not."
"You will."
"Is it a secret?"
"You said you wanted it that way."
"Yes, well, I do. Yes, it's better that way. This is a Bernie onion.
Would Mr. Baker approve?"
"He would if he did it."
"When do you want it?"
"Tomorrow."
"I can't eat this onion. I guess I smell bad enough now, though."
"You're my darling."
"I can't get over Marullo."
"How do you mean?"
"Coming to the house. Bringing candy."
"God works in a mysterious way."
"Now, don't be sacrilegious. Easter isn't over."
"Yes, it is. It's 1:15.
"Good Lord. We better get to sleep."
"Ah, there's the rub. Shakespeare."
"You'd make a joke about anything."
"But it was no joke. The misery stayed, not thought about, but aching away, and sometimes I would have to ask myself, why do I ache? Men can get used to anything, but it takes time. Once long ago, I took a job wheeling nitroglycerin in a dynamite plant. The pay was high because the stuff is tricky. At first, I worried with every step I took, but in a week or so, it was only a job. Why, I'd even got used to being a grocery clerk. There's something desirable about anything you're used to, as opposed to something you're not. In the dark, with the red spots swimming in my eyes, I inquired of myself concerning what they used to call matters of conscience, and I could find no wound. I asked whether, having set my course, I could change direction, or even reverse the compass 90 degrees, and I thought I could, but I didn't want to. I had a new dimension, and I was fascinated with it. It was like discovering an unused set of muscles, or having come true the child's dream that I could fly. Often I can replay events, scenes, conversations, and pick up from the repeat details which escaped me at first showing. Mary found strangeness in Marullo's coming to the house with candy eggs, and I trust Mary's sense of strangeness. I had thought of it as a thanks offering because I had not cheated him. But Mary's question made me reinspect for something I knew but had passed by. Marullo did not reward for things past. He bribed for things to come. He was not interested in me except insofar as I could be of use to him. I went back over his business instruction and the talk about Sicily. Somewhere he had lost his certainty. In some way he wanted something of me or needed something. There was a way to find out. If I should ask for something he would ordinarily refuse and get it from him, then I would know that he was off balance and deeply troubled. I put Marullo aside and went to Margie. "Margie, that gives you an idea of her age. Margie, I'm always dreaming of you, Margie. I'd give the world to—" I replayed the Margie scenes against the swimming spots on the ceiling, trying to add no more than was really there. For a long time, maybe 2 years, there had been a Mrs. Young Hunt who was a friend of my wife, part of the conversations I did not listen to. Then suddenly Margie Young Hunt had emerged, and then Margie. She must have come to the store before Good Friday, but I could not remember it. On that day it was as though she announced herself. Before that, it is possible, she didn't see me any more than I saw her. But from that time on, she was present, a mover and a shaker. What did she want? Could it be pure mischief of a woman with too little to do? Or did she move to a plan? It did seem to me that she had announced herself to me, made me conscious of her and kept me aware of her. It seemed to me that she started the second fortune-telling in good faith, intending it to be the usual performance, polished and professional. Then something happened, something that tore it up. Mary had said nothing to cause her tension, nor had I. Had she really seen the vision of the snake? That would be the simplest explanation and probably the true one. Maybe she was truly intuitive, an intruder into the minds of others. The fact that she had caught me midway in a metamorphosis made me likely to believe this, but it could have been an accident. But what made her run to Montauk when she had not intended to go? Join up with the drummer? Spill the beans to Marullo? Somehow I didn't believe she spilled things she didn't intend to spill. Somewhere in the attic bookcases there was an account of the life of... Was it Bering? No, Baranov. Alexander Baranov, the Russian governor, somewhere near 1800. Maybe there would be some reference to Alaska as a prison for witches. It was too unlikely a story to be made up. I must look. I thought maybe I could creep up there now without waking Mary. Then I heard a creak of the old oak stair treads. Then a second and a third, so I knew it was not the settling of the house from a change of temperature. It had to be Ellen walking in her sleep. Of course I love my daughter, but sometimes she frightens me, for she seems to have been born clever, at once jealous and loving. She was always jealous of her brother, and often I feel she's jealous of me. It seemed to me that her preoccupation with sex began very early. Maybe fathers always feel this. When she was a very little girl, her uninhibited interest in male genitalia was embarrassing. Then she went into the secrecy of change. Here there was no angelic, innocent girlhood of the magazines. The house boiled with nervousness. The walls vibrated with unease. I've read that in the Middle Ages, pubescent girls were thought to be susceptible to witchcraft, and I'm not sure it's not so. For a time we had what we called as a joke, a poltergeist. Pictures fell from their hangings, dishes crashed to the floor. There were poundings in the attic and thumpings in the cellar. I don't know what caused it, but I was interested enough to keep my eye on Ellen, on her secret comings and goings. She was like a night cat. I satisfied myself that she was not responsible for the fallings and crashings and thumpings, but I also found they never happened when she was out of the house. She might be sitting, staring into space when the poltergeist came, but she was always there. As a child, I remember hearing that the old Hawley house was haunted long ago by a ghost of one of the Puritan pirate ancestors, but, according to accounts, he was a decent ghost who walked and wandered and groaned as he should. The stairs creaked under his invisible weight, and he rapped on the wall when a death was imminent, all proper and in good taste. The poltergeist was something quite different, malicious, malignant, and mischievous and vengeful. He never broke a valueless thing. Then he went away. I never really believed in him. He was a family joke, except that there he was, and there were the broken pictures and shattered china. When he left, Ellen began walking in her sleep, as she was now. I could hear her slow but certain footsteps going downstairs. And at the same time, my Mary sighed deeply and murmured beside me. And a breeze sprang up and moved the shadows of leafing limbs on the ceiling. I slipped quietly from my bed and slid into my bathrobe, for I, like everyone else, believe that a sleepwalker should not be startled awake. This sounds as though I didn't like my daughter, but I do. I love her, but I am somewhat in fear of her because I don't understand her. If you use our stairs near the edge on the side of the wall, they do not creak. I discovered that as a tomcatting boy coming home from the back fences of the town. I still use the knowledge, if I do not want to disturb Mary. I used it now, moved silently down the staircase, trailing my fingers against the wall for guidance. A dim and lacy sublight penetrated from the street lamp side and dissipated to semi-darkness away from the window. But I could see Ellen. She seemed to have a glow, perhaps her white nightgown. Her face was shadowed, but her arms and hands picked up light. She was standing at the glass-fronted cabinet where the worthless family treasures are kept, the carved scrimshaw, the sperm whales and boats complete with oars and irons and crews, harpooner in the bow, all carved from whale's bone, like teeth and the curved tusks of walrus. A small model of the Belvedere, shiny with varnish, her furled sails and cordage brown and dusty. There were bits of the chinoiserie the old captains brought from the Orient after they had stripped the China area of sperm whales. Bits and pieces, ebony and ivory, laughing and serious gods, Buddhas, serene and dirty. Carved flowers in rose quartz and soapstone and some jade. Yes, some good jade. And thin cups, translucent and lovely. Some of the things might be valuable, like the small, shapeless horses which yet had life. But if they were valuable, it was an accident. Must have been. How would those sailing, whale-killing men know good from bad? Or would they? Or did they? The cabinet had always been the holy place of the Parenti to me. Roman masks of the ancestors, or the Lares and Penates back to a stone fallen from the moon. We even had a mandrake root, a perfect little man sprouted from the death-ejected sperm of a hanged man, and also we had a veritable mermaid, pretty ratty by now, but cleverly made by sewing the front end of a monkey and the after end of a fish together. It had shrunk with the years, and the stitches showed, but its little teeth still showed in a ferocious smile. I presume that every family has a magic thing, a continuity thing that inflames and comforts and inspires from generation to generation. Ours was a, how shall I say, a kind of mound of translucent stone, perhaps quartz or jadeite, or even soapstone. It was circular, 4 inches in diameter and 1.5 inches at its rounded peak. And carved on its surface was an endless interweaving shape that seemed to move and yet went no place. It was living but had no head or tail, nor beginning or end. The polished stone was not slick to the touch, but slightly tacky, like flesh, and it was always warm to the touch. You could see into it and yet not through it. I guess some old seaman of my blood had brought it back from China. It was magic. Good to see, to touch, to rub against your cheek, or to caress with your fingers. This strange and magic mound lived in the glass cabinet. As child and boy and man, I was allowed to touch it, to handle it, but never to carry it away. And its color and convolutions and texture changed as my needs changed. Once I supposed it was a breast. To me as a boy it became yoni, inflamed and aching. Perhaps later it evolved to brain, or even enigma, the headless, endless, moving thing, the question which is whole within itself, needing no answer to destroy it, no beginning or end to limit it. The glass case had a brass lock from colonial times, and a square brass key always in the lock. My sleeping daughter had the magic mound in her hands, caressing it with her fingers, petting it as though it were alive. She pressed it against her unformed breast, placed it on her cheek below her ear, nuzzled it like a suckling puppy, and she hummed a low song like a moan of pleasure and of longing. There was destruction in her. I had been afraid at first that she might want to crash it to bits or hide it away. But now I saw that it was mother, lover, child in her hands. I wondered how I might awaken her without fright. But why are sleepwalkers awakened? Is it for fear that they might hurt themselves? I've never heard of injury in this state, except through awakening. Why should I interfere? This was no nightmare full of pain or fear, but rather pleasure and association beyond waking understanding. What call had I to spoil it? I moved quietly back and sat down in my big chair to wait. The dim room seemed swarming with particles of brilliant light moving and whirling like clouds of gnats. I guess they were not really there, but only prickles of weariness swimming in the fluid of my eyes. But they were very convincing. And it did seem true that a glow came from my daughter Ellen, not only from the white of her gown, but from her skin as well. I could see her face, and I should not have been able to see it in the darkened room. It seemed to me that it was not a little girl's face at all, nor was it old, but it was mature and complete and formed. Her lips closed firmly, which they did not normally do. After a time, Ellen put the talisman firmly and precisely back in its place, and she closed the glass-fronted case and twisted the brass key that kept it closed. Then she turned and walked past my chair and up the stairs. Two things I may have imagined. One, that she did not walk like a child, but like a fulfilled woman. And second, that as she went, the luminescence drained away from her. These may be impressions, children of my mind, but a third thing is not. As she ascended the stairs, there was no creak of wood. She must have been walking near to the wall, where the treads do not complain. In a few moments I followed her and found her in her bed, asleep and properly covered. She breathed through her mouth, and her face was a sleeping child's face. On compulsion, I went down the stairs again and opened the glass case. I took the mound in my hands. It was warm from Ellen's body. As I had done in childhood, I traced the endless, flowing form with my forefingertip, and I took comfort in it. I felt close to Ellen because of it. I wonder, did the stone bring her somehow close to me? To the Hawleys. Chapter 9. On Monday, perfidious spring dodged back toward winter, with cold rain and raw, gusty wind that shredded the tender leaves of two trusting trees. The bold and concupiscent bull sparrows on the lawns, intent on lechery, got blown about like rags, off course and off target, and they chattered wrathfully against the inconstant weather. I greeted Mr. Red Baker on his tour, his tail blown sideways like a battle flag. He was an old acquaintance, squinting his eyes against the rain. I said, "From now on, you and I can be friends on the surface, but I feel it only right to tell you that our smiles conceal a savage contest, a conflict of interests." I could have said more, but he was anxious to finish his chores and get under cover. The morph was on time. He may have been waiting for me, probably was. "Hell of a day," he said, and his oil-silk raincoat flapped and billowed around his legs. "I hear you did a social turn with my boss." "I needed some advice. He gave me tea, too." "He'll do that. You know how advice is. You only want it if it agrees with what you wanted to do anyway. Sounds like investment. My Mary wants some new furniture. When a woman wants something, she first dresses it up as a good investment." "Not only women, either," said Morph. "I do it myself." "Well, it's her money. She wants to shop around for bargains." At the corner of High Street, we watched a tin sign tear loose from Rapp's toy store and go skidding and screeching along, sounding like a traffic accident. "Say, I heard your boss is going to make a trip home to Italy." "I don't know. Seems odd to me he never went before. Those families are awful close." "Got time for a cup of coffee?" "I ought to get swept out. Should be a busy morning after the holiday." "Oh, come on. Live big. The personal friend of Mr. Baker can afford time for a cup of coffee." He didn't say it meanly, the way it looks in print. He could make anything sound innocent and well-intentioned. In all the years I'd never gone into the Four Masters